We are importing people with college degrees, so that's great, but we're exporting people who don't have college degrees. And ultimately, that's going to play out so that almost everyone here is either in a high-paid profession or an immigrant. And that will be the character of the city. Whereas 30 years ago, Los Angeles was very much a middle-class city.
The high cost of housing is changing our region. Our series, There Goes the Neighborhood, looks at who's staying and who's leaving. But first, after a fierce backlash, the Walt Disney Company has ended a ban on LA Times film critics going to screenings of its movies. The National Society of Film Critics, as well as critics associations in LA, New York, and Boston, had voted to disqualify Disney films from year-end awards consideration. And some critics had said they, too, would not go to advanced screenings of Disney films. The reason for the ban? Disney unhappy about an investigative report the LA Times did on the company's business dealings with the city of Anaheim. Disney called the coverage inaccurate and wholly driven by a political agenda. Claudia Puig is president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great. And Matt Bellany is editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Claudia, so you must feel some satisfaction. You were one of the authors of this letter saying that your organization would not screen Disney movies and not consider them for awards. So what's your reaction to their decision to rescind the ban on the LA Times critics?
We're very happy. This is exactly what we had hoped would happen. We didn't want to retaliate against any particular film or, you know, artist. So, This is really fantastic news.
And Matt, so Disney puts out this big blockbuster movie last week, Thor Ragnarok, and does not allow the LA Times newspaper critics into the screening, so they couldn't have a review in the Friday paper. What did you make of that?
Media companies and Hollywood companies in particular are not shy about taking action against particular journalists. I've seen many journalists, including some at Hollywood Reporter, banned from events and different screenings and such. But what was unique about this ban was that it was so broad. It was all journalists. It was any contact with the paper. And it really, you know, this was for a story that originated in the parks division of Disney. It was about the Disneyland theme park. And to have that impact, all of the critics that were reviewing movies in the entertainment division, that was somewhat surprising.
Right. And so do you think that not only was it the critics who critics groups who said that they would not consider Disney films in their award ceremonies, but also there was some pushback from people like Ava DuVernay, the director of A Wrinkle in Time that comes out next March, saying that she sided with the critics.
Right. And I think this is where Disney really miscalculated here, whether it was Bob Iger or his chief communications person or whoever made this decision. I don't think they really realized that this would start to touch their talent, that the talent that they work with would be upset by this. And people who believe in a free press and media rights, especially in this age when the president is attacking the media and there are so many people that are anti-media, and the Disney Corporation itself just had to pay a gigantic settlement for their ABC News division over a story about pink slime in South Dakota. This is the media is under attack in a lot of different ways, and you would think that the world's biggest media company would defend those rights, and instead they were attacking.
Yeah, and Bob Iger's wife is dean of USC's journalism school. Willow
that
Bay.
Is an ironic note as well. Yes,
Claudia, you have been a critic for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, as he was saying, I have certainly seen them take action, you know, against specific journalists if they didn't like a review, you know, somebody wouldn't be invited to a screening. That kind of thing has happened, but I had never seen anything quite like this, and they definitely miscalculated. And I think, you know, given the times that we live in, and sort of, you know, the dangerous times that we live in terms of, you know, retribution to journalists and sort of the, you know, the idea that this could set a precedent, I think that, you know, they were not prepared for this kind of outrage and backlash. So it's nice to know that we can raise our voices and be heard.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, though, Matt, Thor did gross something like $430 million worldwide. So not having a review in the LA Times didn't seem to hurt the film's numbers in any way.
No, and that's not the kind of film that it's really going to hurt. But what would hurt Disney is this award season backlash that happened, where a lot of the people, the critics groups, were not going to consider Disney films for awards. And when you're building an Oscar campaign, those groups like LA Film Critics, New York Film Critics, the Hollywood Foreign Press, a lot of these media groups can be key indicators and launching points for Oscar campaigns. So that's really where it would have hurt.
Okay. And how influential are they on the Oscars?
The critics groups?
Yeah.
For the right kind of movie, absolutely. I think Disney this year is truly trying to push Beauty and the Beast for the Golden Globes and potentially for Best Picture for the Oscars. And if it starts, that was a well-reviewed movie. If it starts to get some traction amongst these critics groups, it could score a nomination. And that's really big for Disney. So I think that these film critic groups are important to a studio, much more important than one critic at one paper.
And ironically, this whole dust up has drawn more attention to the original article, right? More people are reading it now than perhaps they had, or they're now downloading it. It came out in September, I believe. Matt, tell us briefly why Disney was so unhappy about that article.
Well, you know, it was not unlike, you know, any big town newspaper would do about a big company in their backyard. It was basically about how the Walt Disney Company had lobbied the city of Anaheim and used its muscle to extract a number of favorable tax rulings where they saved upwards of, you know, the story suggested almost $1 billion in taxes for doing business in the city of Anaheim. And there were some ways that they went about pressuring the city council there and trying to get their friendly candidates into the city council that I think Disney was upset by. I've heard that they were also upset by the process behind the story. They didn't feel like they were being heard. They felt like there was an agenda going on behind the story. But, you know, if an objective reader of that story would not think that it was anything unusual for a big metro newspaper to do on a gigantic company that is operating in its backyard.
Yeah, and the LA Times noted when Disney objected to it, saying that they hadn't asked for any corrections or anything.
No, and that's you know, an interesting fact, because you would think that if there was something factually wrong about the story, they would have asked for a correction. And they didn't. So they just didn't like it.
And Claudia, will you be issuing another letter later today saying that you will now, your organization and the others will now? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. We will. Yeah. And, you know, in addition to Beauty and the Beast, I might add that I think this, personally, I thought this was going to hurt Coco as a best animated feature,
right,
which was coming out. So, and I felt as a Latina that I was really pained by that. So I'm really happy that they've done this, and I think it was the right thing to do. And obviously, they were, you know, operating with out of some sort of insidious or more petty, idea of retribution. And somebody has seen the light and realized that that was not the way to go.
Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Matt Bellany, editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we asked the Walt Disney Studios for comment on the blackout and their concerns with the LA Times story on Anaheim. And they told us at noon today, we've had productive discussions with the newly installed leadership at the Los Angeles Times regarding our specific concerns. And as a result, we've agreed to restore access to advanced screenings for their film critics. So that was their official statement from Disney to us. Coming up on the program, There Goes the Neighborhood. Our series on the high price of housing looks at the people leaving LA and those who are still coming.
Let's do it. Let's hit on all eight cylinders. Let's go. Let's do it. I'm in Cali. There's no better opportunity than California.
Okay, living the dream next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's time for our series on housing and gentrification in LA. There goes the neighborhood.
We have got into a lot of complaining about our cities.
We have to fix them. We have to overcome unaffordability. We have to deal with gentrification. We have to deal with inequity. We have to make them more inclusive. But they really are our economic drivers and generators. They really point us to a better future.
I took my Corvette, loaded it up, and put every bit of my clothes and stuff in it to where I could see just enough through the mirrors to get to California.
Well, I'm an actor, but I can't completely pay my rent yet doing that, but I'm getting closer.
I think that my room alone is double what I used to spend in San Diego, just for a bedroom. It's small.
You can have both. You can have a huge population of very wealthy people and at the same time continue to have a city that is open to all and allows for economic mobility. And if we continue to price the poor and even middle-income folks out of Los Angeles, we are making the American dream harder to achieve for millions of people.
Oklahoma is a place where you go to die. You don't go there to build up, you know? You come to California to build up, go back to Oklahoma to die. There you go.
There goes the neighborhood. This week, who's coming to Los Angeles, who's leaving, and why? Here's KCRW's Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez.
Good morning. Welcome to Central Casting. This is for new registration.
On a recent chilly morning, there was a long line outside of a nondescript building in the San Fernando Valley. The people in that line have left their hometowns and families behind and have come to Los Angeles for a shot at something better. They hope to get cast as extras in movies and TV shows.
It's LA and it's Hollywood and, you know, the old cliche, it's where dreams are made, right?
Jennifer Bender is the vice president of Central Casting. Yeah, there really is a company called Central Casting.
Oftentimes they've come from other states, other places of the country, and they've just arrived. Sometimes they drove in last night and they arrived here, or they just arrived recently and this is their first stop to get work in Los Angeles.
And this is kind of the first rung for a lot of them, right? For
this
making a life in LA.
Absolutely, absolutely. Many times they come here, they don't even know what they want to do, but they know they want to be in the entertainment business.
Even before these newcomers get their first gig, they've got another challenge: finding an affordable place to live. Sean Walsh, who's 23, drove over 1,000 miles to stand in this line.
I came from Oklahoma for a better beginning, a new beginning. And the cost of living down here is it's kind of crappy. Like, it costs a lot of money to live here.
I asked Sean, who's here with his brother, how they're getting by.
Well, living situation now is in a car. Yeah.
So you're just park overnight someplace? And
yeah, we just park, you know, train station over there because we can park 9 hours at a time, sleep during the nighttime at the train station, and in the morning come to Central Casting, and that's it.
Actor and musician Chris Judd came to L.A. from a small town in the California desert. He says his housing anxiety is pretty much constant.
How long have you been here?
7 years.
Coming up in September. Anytime during those 7 years where it's like, I don't know where the hell I'm going to live or where I'm going to go.
Yeah, I feel like that's a daily thing for me. It's a thought that passes through my head every single day that I have to counteract with positivity and just saying, hey, no, this is like the place to be. Anything else just seems boring to me.
And here's the thing. What Chris just said, I heard that from pretty much everyone I talked to in the Central Casting line. Yeah, LA is a tough place to live, they say, but there's no place they'd rather be. And there's no way they're going back to wherever they came from.
Let's do it. Let's hit on all 8 cylinders. Let's go. Let's do it. I'm in Cali. There's no better opportunity than California. None.
LA in particular.
Yeah, exactly. I went to see the ocean for my first time yesterday in my whole 23 years of life. Yes. And it was beautiful.
I'm Saul Gonzalez, and this is There Goes the Neighborhood LA. A lot of people love Los Angeles and think this is the place they have to be to get ahead. But LA isn't the population magnet it used to be. Here's KCRW's Anna Scott.
Right. Our population is still growing, with almost 4 million people in the city of LA as of this year. But that growth is from babies being born, immigrants from other countries, and people living longer. It's not because of people moving here from other states. That's true all over California. One person who's researched this is Philip Reese, a reporter for the Sacramento Bee.
For the past 15 or 16 years consecutively, there have been more people leaving California for other states than coming here from them.
So, who's moving out? Philip recently analyzed about a decade's worth of census data, and he found that low-income people are fleeing California.
So a net loss of our impoverished of about 800,000.
And where are people going?
Texas. Texas and neighboring states to us, pretty much anywhere where it's cheaper to live. And Texas has been the main beneficiary of this trend, if you will.
When he said Texas, I immediately thought of Aura Valenzuela. She's the single mom I interviewed for episode one. She's facing eviction from her rent-controlled Hollywood apartment. And when I asked her where she might go next, she said maybe someplace else in LA County or
possibly in the future moving out of California. Texas, Oklahoma, or Michigan.
So it sounds like if Aura's family moves to Texas, she'll find a lot of other ex-Californians there already.
Yeah. And meanwhile, who's moving in? Philip looked at the LA metro area, which includes Los Angeles and Orange counties.
We've seen a net gain in particular of people who are wealthy, if you will, or relatively wealthy. And it really shows up if you look at those with and without a college degree. The Los Angeles metro had a net gain in the last decade of over 20,000 residents with college degrees, even though the metro lost over 250,000 people who are at or near the poverty line. And the professions with the highest net gain were software developers and physicians.
So when people see how high housing prices are lately and they wonder who can afford that, that's really part of the answer, right?
Yeah. LA is attracting well-educated people, doctors, and tech workers. It's right there in the data. Meanwhile, cashiers, retail workers, and truck drivers are moving out, to name a few. This is also a story of race. There are a lot more Latino and Black people moving out than in. That's true of whites and Asians, too, but the disparity is way bigger for Brown and Black people.
So what happens to a city when only rich people can afford to live there? You'll hear more about that in a minute. First, though, where are the people who are moving to LA coming from?
Well, a lot of the time, they're coming from states with an even higher cost of living than California. Here's Philip.
We had a net gain of residents from New York, where it's in many places even more expensive to live than here.
Places like Brooklyn.
There's a certain point where you just graduate out of New York, or you're just like, I'm too old for this, you know?
Alex Howell and his wife, Yaz Yaganagi, moved this year from Brooklyn's Clinton Hill neighborhood to Venice Beach. They moved here for Alex's new job, doing marketing for a yoga website. They picked Venice because they wanted to live near the beach, and Alex can bike to work. Yaz works from home for an Israeli startup. They live in a 1920s Spanish duplex. They pay almost $4,000 a month for it, and they see it as a good deal.
We really lucked out with where we landed now. You know, in the apartment we were in Brooklyn, the rent that they put it up for after we left was $3,800, and we're renting this place for $3,800, and we have a two-bedroom versus, like, a glorified studio there.
So far, they love it here, even though they find LA's culture to be a little bit different than New York's.
I definitely was asked to hold a crystal in a work meeting. That was a surprise.
We're leaning in. I've done some weird things. Like, I bought $30 Manuka honey. You know, I've spent probably like $150 on fresh juices already. But, you know, it's all in the name of a healthier West Coast lifestyle. So we're very happy.
I asked how much of their income they spend on rent.
So let's just round up to 448. So
15%.
Or no, yeah, it's closer to 20.
20%. Yeah. So like a fifth of take home pay.
Yeah, roughly.
That's a really good ratio.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to many, you know.
That's... Yeah. It still feels though. I mean, there's this like psychological thing about it feels like you're flushing that money every month. that amount creates this urgency in my mind to like want to own something.
But guess what? Even they feel priced out of the markets they'd like to buy in, neighborhoods near the beach.
You open Zillow and all it is like a sea of houses that are like $1.3 million and north of that. We're doing really well for ourselves. And yet it still feels basically unattainable, which means, okay, do we live in Baldwin Hills? Maybe, I don't know, Inglewood.
We reported on Inglewood earlier in this series and how the tech industry near the beach puts a lot of pressure on housing prices there. Well, this is what it looks like from Venice. I asked Alex what he'd say to those who might see him as just another gentrifier, making the city more expensive.
I feel great guilt all the time. It's like, I don't know how to not be myself, but I like, this is who I don't, I'm the problem everywhere I go in terms of neighborhood change, you know, like it's, I've lived in like all of the amenity rich stereotypical cities that everyone's moving to. I lived in the Northeast in Portland. I lived on the east side of Austin for 4 years. But I'm acutely aware of our role in this. I just don't really know how to not, how to be a part of the solution without being a part of the problem also.
Up next, people who've had it with LA and are saying, I'm out of here. When the Gold Line train arrives at the Highland Park station between downtown LA and Pasadena, passengers get off in a rapidly gentrifying part of Los Angeles. And change is just steps from the station, at an apartment building once known as the Marmion Royal. The building has new owners, and they've priced out 50 families over the past year as they've remodeled it and raised rents. Lizzie Brumfield and her fiancé were evicted this past summer from the Marmion. The couple and their baby stayed at his sister's place for a few months.
I was putting a lot of stress on my family to look for a place, especially here in LA, not having the ability to afford what's around the area. After a while, it just gets overwhelming living with someone else. You kind of want your own place after that.
Now they're leaving LA. KCRW producer Miguel Contreras met up with them on moving day.
Lizzie and her fiancé looked in L.A. and then in Bakersfield before they finally found an affordable apartment.
We actually got one in Hemet for $925. It's a two-bedroom, two-bath. So it has more space for us. It's just taking so much of a hassle to get out there.
Hemet, where they're moving to, is an exurb about 90 miles southeast of L.A. in Riverside County.
We're going from being close to family to living practically almost 2 hours away.
Hemet, that's kind of a refuge for people priced out of L.A.
Yeah, actually, that area has been a magnet for Angelenos for a long time because it's cheaper to live out there.
Dad, this isn't going to fit.
What?
This isn't going to fit. What do you mean it's not going to fit?
Lizzie's father and brother are lugging a bed out of her storage unit. It's one of those heavy, adjustable ones you see in infomercials. This is Lizzie's dad, Christopher.
It hurts my daughter and her boyfriend and the baby, you know, and it's wrong, but unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about it.
And it hurts you.
Yeah. I mean, now it's probably going to be a lot harder to go see my granddaughter, you know, see my daughter.
Lizzie's fiancé, Christian, works as a security guard in Hollywood. He's looking for a job near Hemet, but he doesn't have one yet. So his plan for now is to crash somewhere in L.A. during the week and go back to Hemet on weekends.
So it's kind of going to be hard being separated from my daughter and obviously my fiancé, but we have to make what's best right now.
So for the time being, Lizzie plans to be with their 11-month-old daughter in Hemet on their own.
All right.
We're done, right? That's everything?
Everything, yeah, well, that's it, everything.
It's time to say goodbye.
Well, no more L.A. traffic, put it that way. I'm excited. Start a new chapter.
Hello.
Hi, Lizzie. It's Miguel. 4 weeks after moving, they're trying to figure it out down in Hemet.
It's been working out a lot better. The transition was very hard, especially for me. I was bored out of my mind up here. I had nothing to do except take care of my daughter and then go to school, which is online, obviously, so I'm stuck at home.
A few weeks ago, Christian's employer transferred his job as a security guard from Hollywood to nearby Moreno Valley.
His job is really good. There's a lot of overtime, so he's pushing in a lot more hours than he did over there.
And you said it turned out for the better?
Yeah, it is. It is working out very well. I mean, it sucks because we're not anywhere near home. Once things are more situated, we'll be able to go down more often. But for sure, around the holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, that type of time, we'll be down there. We won't be spending it up here by ourselves. We'll be with family.
One person who's thought a lot about the long-term consequences of people like Lizzie leaving Los Angeles is Richard Green. He directs USC's Luss School of Real Estate. Green says if LA doesn't fix its housing affordability crisis, we could end up looking a lot like another California city.
We're sort of following San Francisco in this regard. If you look at San Francisco, if you look at LA 50 years ago, and if you look at their income distributions, they were very similar to the country as a whole. So big middle class, some rich people, some poor people, but like the country as a whole. City of San Francisco now basically has two kinds of people in it. It has very rich people and people in rent-controlled units and some people with subsidized housing, and that's it. The middle class in San Francisco has shrunk dramatically. We're seeing that here play out in Los Angeles. We are importing people with college degrees, so that's great, but we're exporting people who don't have college degrees. And ultimately, that's going to play out so that almost everyone here is either in a high-paid profession or an immigrant. And that will be the character of the city. Whereas 30 years ago, Los Angeles was very much a middle-class city.
And those immigrants who still remain here, they're kind of become essentially a service class for the wealthy or the upper middle class. And they provide, they're the gardeners, the nannies, the...
Exactly. And you don't have to look too far to see that that's exactly what's going on.
A lot of other people could stay in L.A., but they figure why. They take a good, hard look at the city and say, hey, Los Angeles, the problem is you, not me in this relationship. I'm leaving you for someplace that's less expensive and high maintenance. Psychologically, it's a lot easier to be the one dumping L.A. than to feel like you're the one who's been dumped. Take Southern California native Mason Cooley, for example. He always felt like this was his home. But as he told KCRW's Anna Scott, when he and his wife drove out of L.A. on their way to Asheville, North Carolina a few years ago, he suddenly didn't feel that way anymore.
I didn't really expect it, but this sort of overwhelming feeling that it was terminal came over me. I just kind of realized that, you know, when you leave L.A., you're essentially already replaced by so many other people coming in. And I never really felt like Los Angeles was the kind of city that was going to miss you or something. I don't know if that sounds weird.
Mason's 43 years old. And 4 years ago, he was working as an art professor at Cal State Long Beach, earning about $50,000 a year. His wife's an optician, and they both make custom furniture on the side.
When I left L.A. in 2014, we were renting a house in Van Nuys, and the rent was $2,300 a month.
Was that a two-bedroom, two-bath?
Yeah, it was actually a pretty good size. I mean, I was lucky to find it. You know, I didn't really like living in Van Nuys, but it was really the only place I could afford to rent that size house.
They wanted to buy a house, but it seemed financially impossible here.
And, you know, I think when I was younger, in my 20s, I kept thinking like, oh, I know, I'm not going to worry about it. You know, it'll happen. There'll be an opportunity. And then I hit 40 and I was like, I still don't have any opportunity here to really purchase anything. And so as the rent increased, yeah, it was really frustrating.
They picked Asheville because they'd read some articles about it. It's a small mountain city known for its art scene, and they thought it sounded nice and affordable. Now they own their own home. They built it themselves on 2 acres of land that they got by trading a bunch of custom furniture. It's modest, a 900-square-foot apartment over a furniture workshop. But it allows them to live mortgage-free.
We did have some cash saved up, and I was able to budget without taking a construction loan out.
The whole thing cost about $100,000. Mason doesn't plan to ever move back to Los Angeles.
We really love it here.
But he says an interesting thing is happening in Asheville. He's meeting more and more people like himself, new arrivals from other cities escaping high housing prices.
If you go out at a restaurant or a cafe, or you just run into somebody random, more often than not, the story they share is like a very similar story. And people are from New York and Brooklyn and Los Angeles and Portland and Austin. And the cost of living, I mean, it's not Los Angeles, but it's definitely rising here.
What Mason is noticing is real. Asheville's population grew about 7% between 2010 and 2016, according to census numbers. It's still small, less than 90,000 people within city limits, but it's growing. Mason's advice?
If you have any extra money laying around, you can invest it here.
The median home value in Asheville is about $257,000, less than half of what it is in LA. But in the past year, it's gone up almost 10%.
What's happening in Asheville, Los Angeles, and so many other cities around the country, it's a kind of economic sorting. And it's part of a national phenomenon that's way bigger than any single city.
Property, as with a lot of other wealth in the society, is becoming more and more concentrated. And the more concentrated it becomes, in some ways, the weirder the market is in terms of how it functions.
Cynthia Strathman is the executive director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. She says gentrification is tied to nationwide, even global economic forces. So, how can you ever address that at the city level? What can Angelenos who want to live in an economically and racially diverse city do?
I think you actually hit on a really key question, because part of the problem is that the forces that impact gentrification are largely national or supranational, whereas the tools that we have to address land use concerns are largely municipal. But I think there are ways that you can intervene.
But how? Next time on There Goes the Neighborhood LA, we've spent a lot of time talking about Los Angeles's problems. But what are some solutions when it comes to housing and gentrification?
We've committed on our land that 35% of the units built on metro-owned land will be affordable to low-income families. So we're saying we're making a commitment to affordable housing, and that commitment is made in spite of how challenging it is to have enough public subsidy to do it all. So it stands to us to figure out with our city partners how to make that happen.
We want to hear about your experiences with the high cost of living in Los Angeles. You can tell us about it on Facebook or Twitter, and you can come participate live. I'm hosting a There Goes the Neighborhood discussion at the Central Library next Wednesday, the 15th, at 6 o'clock. Go to kcrw.com/theregoestheneighborhood for more info and to RSVP. Coming up, two members of the band Chicano Batman are here. We'll talk about their experiences in the year since Donald Trump was elected. Well, for one, they put out a new album, which is overtly political. It's called Freedom is Free. Chicano Batman, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
You got your guns up on display, but you can't control how I feel, no way.
The title track from Chicano Batman's latest album, Freedom is Free, released the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. The video for that song features each of the band members being tortured, drowned by two nondescript agents in aviator sunglasses. Freedom is Free is the most political album yet from the psychedelic soul band, but They are still as funky as ever. Well, since it's the one-year anniversary of the election, we wanted to talk to Chicano Batman about this past year, about their new album. Two of the four members are here now. Eduardo Arenas, he plays bass and sings for the band. Welcome to you.
Hello.
And Bardo Martinez is the lead vocalist. He plays organ and guitar as well. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, Bardo, Freedom is Free. It was written, well, it was written before Trump was elected, right?
Yes.
And so how are you feeling about the direction of the country when you wrote that song and the other ones on the album?
Well, I'm a student of history. I have a BA in history and an MA in Latin American studies. Mm-hmm. So I've read plenty of books in school. And, you know, you're always grappling with the state of the world, you know, wherever it's at.
Yeah.
You know, this country has always been in constant turmoil, just like the rest of the world, really. Mm-hmm. And so the state of the world now is it's just another phase of a lot of struggle. And so I think the context is to bring a little light to that darkness by
and
saying,
like,
you know.
Yeah, and light, too, yeah. Because the music is so jaunty. I like the juxtaposition between the serious lyrics and the jaunty music.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it could be, you know, funky and upbeat because it all rolls up into one, right? We could be surrounded by a lot of dark and bad things, but we could be happy and good at the same time.
And Eduardo, touring in support of this album this last year, you guys have been touring for many, many years, but this last year, have you felt anything different?
The number one thing we felt is just support. We've been feeling a lot of support since the beginning of launching the album, our tour in the spring, all over the South, the Midwest. And, you know, there's definitely, when we would tour, we would look around and we'd think, okay, I think we're in Trump country now. And it's evident by all the signs everywhere, like in Central Texas. And I think our instinct is to say we're in hostile territory, and we go to a diner and it's just like in the middle of nowhere. And then people turn out to be nice. So I think it's a lesson also learned about not playing that game where you're judging other people too just because of their political beliefs. Just like we're entering this territory with a very hostile mentality. And I think it's been an interesting thing not to judge everywhere you go because that's what they're doing to you. Mm. And if you want to avoid that game, just don't play it.
That's interesting. Have you ever had conversations with Trump supporters when you're on tour?
In fact, yeah. And Bartos here smiling too because our bus driver right now is a mad Trump supporter and all the politics that come with it. So you can imagine the juxtaposition of that. Chicano yeah. Batman being driven around the country with a Trump supporting a bus driver who's great at his job. It's just, we're just not great at his politics.
How did you find out that he was a Trump supporter?
I think we just started talking one day and then it just bled. He was prideful in talking about all his political views about the BLM movement. I've never heard that before, BLM. I'm like, oh, you mean Black Lives Matter? I never heard an acronym, and he was schooling me on that.
Didn't he mean the Bureau of Land Management? Or did he actually mean Black Lives Matter?
The Bureau of Land Management is a terrorist organization, according to him. So there you go. So it's interesting because we can push our own politics, our own ideas of freedom, of peace, but we're always going to be confronted by this reality. So it's almost a great exercise to bounce it off of our own bus driver.
So have you been able to convince him on anything like on immigration or anything like that?
Absolutely not. No way.
But I think the only thing we've been able to convince him of is just that we're humans just like him and we could have a good time together. And actually, we've been having a good time. Like, because we get on the bus like at 4 a.m. and that's when he drives us off. And it's like, you know, we're done with the night's over. Everybody's kind of like decompressing. And so just landing on something normal, like laughing and comedy and just being ourselves.
Exactly. I remember having a roommate back in the day. It was a white dude from Baltimore into banking was his profession. And he was just homophobic. He was just like, he just didn't tolerate a lot of things. And living with us for a couple of years just by association and acculturation, you know, just he started kind of understanding what we're about. And I think with this experience with the bus drivers, just maybe after a month, you might just have a little bit of compassion about how we have similar struggles, and yeah, we're hungry at the same time, and you know, we laugh at the same things, and that's an entry into any relationship.
I want to play another bit of a song. This is your recording of This Land Is Your Land, and you did this for a Johnny Walker ad, but I want to play your take on it.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me, yeah.
So that's an old Woody Guthrie song. We've all heard that song before. But how did you want to update it?
Just want to make it funky.
But you also added some Spanish lyrics in there.
Yeah. Well, actually, that was put together by Anomaly, which is the ad agency that put the whole thing together. Mm-hmm. They're the ones, they had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do with the video. And it's essentially, you know, bring a Latino spin on this song, like a fresh interpretation.
And it's provocative.
Yeah.
Because it comes at a right time. I mean, they also launched, I think, around the Trump's first day in office, and it's basically, it's a wake-up call that America looks like this. You know, this is what it looks like right now. This is what progress looks like in the country, and it goes against Trump's idea of making America great again, and how he acts to develop that idea, like not responding to Nazi terrorism in the country, and not responding to things that he needs to as a leader in this country. But this is the face of reality right now in our city, in our world. And I think for us to sing that song, at first we were hesitant, because growing up, we would think that the song was like a patriotic song about this country, about the flag. You do the flag salute, and then you do this song or something. And it wasn't until when we were digging into it, we realized the political context of the song and how inspiring it could be. And we've played it different parts of the country, and a lot of people have reacted really well. People have writing dissertations on the song and us doing it and what that means at this time in politics of our country. And it started something.
Yeah. I wonder, when you're doing a song like that, and then also you guys are marinated in like 60s and 70s soul, and that music is a big influence on you and your sound and your look, even with those, you know, tuxedos that you wear with the frilly shirts. And I'm wondering if you're kind of looking at that music differently as a now, that music from the 60s and 70s, while it was really fun and great dance music, that soul and that funk also was political in a way.
Yes, most definitely. I mean, I think we're fortunate to look at it in hindsight. And I think that's why we're also able to appreciate it. We're not the only ones, you know, digging into 60s and 70s music. And yes, it's always been very political. You know, back in the day, people only have so much to work with, technologically speaking. So they got to keep it more real. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So the music was definitely more real in every sense of the word, whether it's people's politics, whether it's, you know, just the music itself, really, how it's recorded. Like, you know, it's one take. You know, it's like five musicians in a room recording all the music together. So, I mean, that's the flavor that we also try to approximate and by doing that. And yes, I mean, it's just such a beautiful, such an inspiring world that was happening.
Yeah.
In that time period.
Do you feel like it's your responsibility as a band to bring up political issues? I mean, you could just make fun dance hits and talk about love instead.
I think we do that still. I think we get asked that question a lot, especially this year. And I don't think Chicano Batman has necessarily been a political band. I mean, I think it's a statement about, I mean, innate in the name, I guess, yeah, it's political. It's just kind of giving light to the everyday hero. Mm-hmm. But I think what we've not decided, but it's kind of just apparent in our music, is that love is sometimes the strongest politic that we could talk about. And I think we've been pushing that angle up until a certain point where some of that love is now love for for something bigger, for justice. And I think everybody comes to a point where you just got to say what's in your heart. And some of these topics have really come close to home. Police brutality, pollution of our soil, you know, just working against peace. I mean, these are things that, especially as musicians, they're things that we try to encapsulate in the music and the vibration that we're pushing when we perform. And it's not happening in real life, right back at us.
And I think more and more, I think musicians and bands and artists are flipping, you know, those preconceptions of what a band has to be.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Eduardo Arenas and Baro Martinez. They are two of the four members of Chicano Batman. Their latest album is Freedom is Free. They'll be here in Southern California this weekend playing this Saturday at the Tropicalia Music and Taco Festival in Long Beach.
You've got an open heart, so you share what's inside, thinking that all is said in confidence, but then you realize...
Chicano Batman, friendship is a small boat in a storm. Hi there, Christian.
Hey,
you can
there,
get
Madeline
behind
Brand.
That sentiment,
absolutely.
Right?
I love that band.
I know,
their
stuff
is really cool.
They
have such a creative approach to songwriting, too. Like that song, for example, just like puts the chorus right at the beginning and just does all of this stuff
and that organ,
you wouldn't expect.
Love
and
that
the organ.
Organ
is great, yep. Anyway, well, we talked earlier, we had the latest installment of There Goes the Neighborhood. We heard that wealthier people with college degrees are moving into the city. Poorer, less educated people are moving out. So I put up a little Twitter poll asking people, considering things like traffic, safety, environment, culture, how has the city changed during their time here? The result is 30% of people say it's changed for the better. 52% say it's changed for the worse. And 18% say about the same. So I guess people aren't completely positive about the direction. Sandy Galen said, traffic is much worse. Cultural opportunities are better. Ageism is raging, which is kind of interesting. And Carson says, I love my city, but I'm afraid I won't be able to afford to live here anymore, which is kind of a common sentiment, I think. We should also mention that tomorrow we here at Press Play are doing a special edition of Press Play.
Yeah, we're doing an hour call-in show. This is we did this last year right the day after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so tomorrow will be
the one-year anniversary.
The one-year anniversary of that.
Yeah.
Of the election. So we are going to give you the number right now. You can write it down and keep it by your side for tomorrow if you want to call in. 877-600-KCRW, 877-600-5279. And we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
So that's that.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.